There's something out here.
Holy hell.
You think it's a UFO?
The next level of the Jordan Peele experience arrives.
Yeah, nah. Run!
I don't think they think you. Yeah. Keep you on look at it.
No.
Don't look.
Yeah. It's not what you think.
Nope.
Written and directed by Jordan Peele. In cinemas now.
It's the World Soccer Talk podcast, the only podcast that focuses on watching soccer on TV, online, and apps. In episode 102, we discuss a huge weekend of soccer viewing in the US, with five games averaging more than 1 million viewers. John Champion bids farewell to the Premier League, our thoughts on the MLS Cup final and the TV rating, and we have a bunch of letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section. My name is Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, and I'm joined by my co-host, Kartik Krishnaya. Kartik, it's been a crazy week of soccer. I don't know about you, but in terms of everything that's gone on since the last podcast, we had some big games in the Premier League, we had the Fan Fest, we had the MLS Cup Final, we had the River Boca Final in the Copa Libertadores, we had Liga MX. The semi-finals, now we know who's going to be playing in the final. This is recording this Thursday. The first match is tonight. So, and then, of course, the Champions League and Turner Sports sending people over to Spain to commentate that game. A lot to get into. Where would you like to start?
Well, for me, I had a Fox-heavy weekend. For me personally, maybe the most important match was on Friday. It was Bremen and Fortuna Dusseldorf. I cleared my schedule to watch this match, knowing Josh Sargent, the American phenom. And I don't get as excited about young Americans. I think it's people who know me know this, as others, including Pulisic. I mean, I still have some skepticism about Pulisic long term as a as the kind of superstar, global superstar so many Americans have made him out to be. But Sargent has something about him that I've noticed. So I was real excited about this and watched this match on Fox. He gets on, he scores within 2 minutes. Yes, it was a bit of a sitter.
That had to be the luckiest goal I've ever seen in my life.
No, it wasn't the luckiest goal.
Well, as far as the goalkeeper, it hit his shoulder. The goalkeeper had no idea where it went. The ball goes up flying. Positionally wise, yeah, he was in the right place at the right time. But
that's something. That's something that I noticed in the 15, 20 minutes he was on the pitch. He almost scored another goal. Is that, and this is why I'm so excited about this kid. I think I watch football a lot differently than most Americans do. His positioning sense, the runs I've seen him make off the ball when playing for the national team and the youth national teams, the composure when he gets a touch on the ball are some things you don't normally see in American players. Yeah, I guess Pulisic does have it. I think Michael Bradley was a guy that had it. That's going to cause all kinds of anger on this podcast. But in terms of actual attacking players, number nines, I don't think we've had a guy quite with that skill set, maybe since Eric Winalda. And Brian McBride was fantastic, did a lot through hard work. Jozy Altidore has had gaps in his game. So that's why I was excited about this. I cleared my schedule, watched this match in its entirety, taped Juve-Inter, which was going on at the same time, and watched this. Juve-Inter was a good match. Watched that on the DVR. ESPN becoming very comfortable in Serie A. And there was an ESPN FC program leading into the match because it was such a big match. Inter, disappointing. They were disappointing in Champions League midweek. Schalke Dortmund I watched, which was a big hype derby, obviously because of the two Americans, in addition to being one of the biggest derbies in Europe, McKinney versus Pulisic. McKinney was very good. Pulisic played for 1 minute. So there's the gap in playing time for those guys now. Keith Costigan and Jovan Karofsky were fantastic. Obviously, Jovan Karofsky's played in this derby, understands the culture around it. Keith Costigan becoming one of the premier voices of football in this country, even though Fox doesn't give him the sort of exposure they probably should on other events. Very, very good broadcast. So I'm thinking, that's a good weekend for Fox, right, Chris?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good start.
Good start. Women's World Cup draws next. I watched that, and it was unwatchable after 20 minutes. I start tweeting, what do I do about this? People suggest, hey, just watch FIFA stream on YouTube. So I did that. I turned Fox off.
Well, I missed it, Kartik, so I didn't see the Women's World Cup draw. And actually on Friday, I think I watched some other matches too. I watched the Sheffield United against West Brom game, I think, which was a really, really entertaining. Actually, no, it wasn't. It was West Brom against, oh gosh, I forgot who it was now.
Aston Villa,
yeah, the derby.
The hand of God. yeah,
with John Champion. So I watched that one, and so that was the 2-2 draw. I really enjoyed that one. But the World Cup draw for the women, I missed it. So why was it so bad? What was bad about it?
It was just all very kind of clunky production, loud graphics, and then talk about the United States. Everything was based on the United States. And the women's game, okay, U.S. is at the top of the women's game, but the women's game is more competitive than ever. And I thought, you and I commented on this a few years ago, that Fox's 2015 Women's World Cup coverage wasn't as jingoistic as we thought it would be until the very end of the tournament, remember? Mm-hmm. But it seems like they're starting early with the draw. So look, it's just, again, personal preference. A lot of people like that. They're driven into the women's game because of the women's national team, U.S. women's national team. I get that. They're catering to that fan base, but I was able to watch it on YouTube. Telemundo was broadcasting it also, I was told, as a lead-in. Instead of doing a pregame to pre-match Chelsea, Man City, they were broadcasting the draws as the lead-in. So I could have watched it there as well. But it was just classic Fox, which continued. Chelsea, Man City, I watched on NBC. We can talk about that in a little more detail later. But then MLS Cup, Chris. Fox's production. Now we're going to talk about their production rather than their actual on-air talent. Their production and level of presentation, it just doesn't have the same feel as an event on ESPN or NBC or even now on Turner. I mean, I'm impressed when I watched Turner's pregame show about how much more the first few weeks were a shambles, right? But how much more professional it seems. The graphics are timed properly, you know, things like that compared to Fox. I just thought it was a very embarrassingly low level production for such a big event and an event that got such good ratings. You know, we can talk about the match. We can talk about John Strong's and Stuart Holden's call. We can nitpick at that stuff, but Fox still, I don't know if it's budget, Chris, or if it's just commitment level or not understanding things, but their production teams are just not at the same level, at least from what we can see on the output, as the other networks.
So some listeners may faint, but I didn't think Fox's coverage was that bad. I guess I was going in with low expectations, especially with the corner flag cam, and thinking about, okay, how bad is this going to be? We're going to focus on silly things that don't need focusing on. I didn't think it was that bad. From a production point of view, yes, there were issues in terms of the camera crews kind of really zooming in too closely to the play, and you weren't able to see what was happening kind of on the fringes of that. My guess is probably they were using a whole bunch of NFL or even college football cameramen in the stadium who were not used to shooting soccer, so that wasn't good. The other issue I had with it was that And this is in contrast now to the Premier League Fan Fest on NBC Sports. But anytime something amazing happens, maybe it was a goal or some incredible save, whatever it may have been, what happened was that on Fox, they would zoom in on this platform, and there would be like three people on the platform standing in front of the crowd. So you'd see maybe somebody holding a flag or two girls or two women kind of high-fiving each other when they scored a goal. And to me, I was like, it wasn't that exciting. I was like, why do you zoom in on this platform of three people standing, just jumping up for joy? But show the crowd, show the fans going crazy. And that's in complete contrast to the Premier League Fan Fest, because anytime something major happened in any of those games, NBC would zoom back into that crowd. So Chelsea scores, even at halftime, they show the highlights of Chelsea scoring, and you see like 200 or 300 Chelsea fans just going crazy, absolutely crazy, jumping up for joy, or even if it's Spurs or Man City, you get that. You'd even capture that emotion and that celebration and that pure joy. And with Fox, it was strange. Like, why are you showing these three people standing on this platform? Yes, the crowd's behind it, but you're focusing on the wrong things. But overall, Kartik, I thought it wasn't that bad. The interesting thing...
Yeah, commentators were fine. I mean, my issue... Thank you for pointing that out, Chris. The camera work, I was going to get to that. The camera work was a disaster.
The interesting thing, I mean, pre-match, I'd like to get your take on this one, where they had the really short interview with Greg Berhalter pre-match. And it was weird for Kartik, because I don't know if Greg Berhalter was nervous, but it seemed to be like very... Kind of Rob Stone was touchy-feely, kind of like patting him on the shoulder, kind of like touching him, and Moadu would do the same thing too, like almost as if like Greg Berhalter was extremely nervous and they were just trying to carry him through the broadcast in terms of answering the questions. Now, the answering the questions he did okay with. He just very short, very didn't really say anything of any substance. I mean, no surprise there, but it didn't fill me with a lot of confidence that this is going to be the man that's leading the U.S. men's national team for the next few years. And at the same time, I just thought it was really weird. Even Rob Stone asking him about his kids. I mean, it just really seemed to be buddy-buddy. It didn't seem to be kind of a, I'm a presenter. I'm going to ask some tough questions here. It was very much, hey, high five, you mean, touch your shoulder type of thing.
Yeah, and that point was not lost on lots of people I've talked to this week who were saying, okay, we're going to give Berhalter a chance. Yeah, we would have preferred a Vermees or Marsh or an Osorio or whoever. And then watched that interview and said, one, I got a lot of feedback on this. One, it's classic Rob Stone as a presenter. And again, I mean, I think we saw the difference between Rob Stone and Kate Abdo this week when you watch Champions League with Holden and Nash out of the studio and in Valencia or in Madrid and then in Valencia, you had this situation where you just had the focus on the three in the Atlanta studio, right? And Kate was asking, I've been critical of her on previous shows, but she was asking some very good questions of Tim Howard and Moadu. And I enjoyed their tactical analysis on the Wednesday show in particular, or actually Tuesday as well, when they talked about how Liverpool was going to play with the ball. And Tim Howard moved the players and kind of showed, you know, an asymmetrical formation, but where he thought Liverpool would end up at the end of the match. And he was right tactically. Rob Stone asked these very soft questions and it wasn't lost on people. And the Berhalter answers and his nervousness or his reluctance, people I've spoken to this week have said, well, this is exactly why the Federation probably wanted him, because he's not going to speak out the way Vermees would. We know how Peter Vermees is, or the way that Jurgen Klinsmann, Bruce Arena previously did. And that also maybe he's a guy that they can very easily script to say certain things. Whereas even if, you know, you try and keep a Vermees on message, I'm using Peter Vermees as the example because he's the guy. He wasn't my first choice for the job, but he's talking to people. It seems like he's the guy getting snubbed that more people around the American game at least are unhappy about than Jesse Marsh, who was my choice. And even if you get Vermees in a situation like that, Chris, with Rob Stone, he'll be spontaneous and he'll probably – you know, go off script. He won't just answer the question, but he'll say something else. Mm-hmm. So it was, I think, a very glaring and telling demonstration for everybody about, one, where the U.S. Federation is and where their heads are, and two, where Fox is and where their heads are.
Yeah, and it was a very short interview. It wasn't anything substantial, too. And it was hard, too, because it's just right before the game is starting. The crowd's loud and crazy, which is a fantastic crowd, a great game for that, but so it's difficult, I think, for him to hear the questions too. So, but yeah, not a good look, and to me, doesn't fill me with a lot of confidence. Now, in terms of the game itself, Kartik, I thought that the teams coming out and then the national anthem was incredible. I was like, wow, this girl can sing. Really great television. But even with the teams coming out and the fireworks and the MLS Cup in the background, and that was great. Great television, and I thought that was really well done. The game itself, Kartik, I was really disappointed. I was expecting Portland to put up more of a fight. This one, Atlanta completely dominated this game, and I don't think Portland had a shot on goal the entire game. And I was really disappointed because I was thinking, okay, this is going to be a really good chess match between these two sides, but it was Atlanta completely dominating the game. And yes, it was watchable. I watched the game with my daughter, sat down, enjoyed it, but it was not the level of a cup final that I was expecting.
you don't remember Gio Savarese. I love Gio. I have a lot of time for him, both as personally and professionally. But you don't remember Gio in some big matches with the New York Cosmos. This is what they did. They would sit deep. Generally, they wouldn't concede that goal, though. Now, actually, in a match I was at, a big NASL championship match between Fort Lauderdale, the team I worked with, and the Cosmos, we scored first up in New York. And then he had to open up. But generally, he sits deep in knockout stage matches. He did it against Kansas City as well. But with the Cosmos, he did the same thing, even though he had, in that league, arguably more talent than the opposition. A lot of our Fort Lauderdale team that year had comparable talent to them. They sit back, generally, teams, and absorb a lot of pressure and try to get to halftime at nil-nil. Parker's crucial goal, which maybe should have been chalked off, but that kind of changed everything. Because I think Gio was tactically playing for a halftime, maybe by the 60th minute, he lets Valeri and company run wild in the second half after a certain point. But it was this is the problem when you get a manager who's thinking defensively and they're away from home in a one-off match. We've seen it in Champions League finals. We've seen it in other one-off matches like this where if there is a goal, if the superior team scores a goal early, that's kind of it, and that's what happened. It wasn't that early, but, yeah, Atlanta dominated the match. And they're just a very, very good team to play, to watch. They're easy on the eye. But I think that there is also a certain degree of, how do I put it, Chris, when I've watched Atlanta recently, including the Red Bulls, which it surprised me from the Red Bulls, there's a certain degree of negativity. I think those of us who watch a lot of European football are used to this. When they're a superior footballing side going up against teams that defensively aren't very good, aren't typically teams that like to play the ball, you get these sorts of matches, and especially in these situations.
Yeah, Atlanta United, and this is that they're not on this level by any means, but Atlanta United reminded me of what Manchester United was in the past when they were so dominant in cup finals, where it would be kind of they would a great team, a fantastic team to watch, attacking, and the other team would be there merely just to make up the numbers, and that's how I felt from this one. Even after the game, I thought to myself, okay, Atlanta, they're losing their coach, they're probably going to lose a couple of their key players, but they could, if they make a smart decision and bring in the right person, actually continue this to be a complete domination and legacy for years to come if they play the cards right. And that was the feeling I got from this match. Now in a weekend that should have been all about the MLS Cup final, I thought it was completely overshadowed by a brilliant River Boca game, the final of the Copa Libertadores, and to me, Kartik, the Premier League weekend that featured Liverpool climbing to the top of the Premier League table. Now you have a title race and an emotional segment by NBC Sports on the important topic of racism in England with Robbie Earle.
But by the way, I did not see that segment, but I did see the segment on TNT with Mo Adu and Tim Howard, and it was really good. On the whatever day pregame show, it would have been when they talked about Sterling, so Wednesday pregame.
Wednesday,
show.
Yeah. And Robbie Earls was really good. I mean, you could tell he was emotional about it. He was talking about it, and then towards the end, you could see that he started to tear up. And Rebecca Lowe, she's reached her hand out and said, basically, thank you for opening up your heart and telling this, because this is a very difficult topic to cover. And Robbie didn't go into a lot of specifics, but did mention about in terms of that he's been through similar experiences in the past before, too, and just gave his honest opinions and just said in terms of the Premier League needing to do more. For anyone who did miss it, definitely check it out, whether it's on YouTube or whether it's on the NBC Sports Soccer Twitter account. It's there, and it's highly recommended. And the Mo Adu, Tim Howard piece midweek too with Kate Abdo, I thought was just as good. I mean, it was really kind of given their honest opinions, and you mean sharing exactly what it feels like, and really just being very, very critical. Very critical against whether it's Sepp Blatter or Infantino or even Jurgen Klopp in terms of the things they've been saying and the lack of what people should be doing, what organizations and FIFA should be doing to try to stamp this out. And it was a topic that was much needed, and I think without Robbie Earls talking about it on Sunday, probably TNT wouldn't have talked about it on Wednesday. But it was all in all, a really touching on both points, but really well worth it and good television. But at the end of the day, a really good message.
Yeah, I think that's coming out of this weekend, though. I think between Copa Libertadores and MLS Cup is that what a fantastic Copa Libertadores final, one of the best matches I've watched this year. Is that Atlanta United, and this is a big challenge for MLS or for MLS fans too. Atlanta United is now emerging as this super club, something MLS has never had before. I mean, that you could say the Galaxy, you could say Seattle, they had very limited kind of niche followings in the global game. Pity Martinez, right after the match, you know, he was one of the stars in the Copa Libertadores final, said, yeah, this is my last River, I'm going to Atlanta United. I could never imagine a player of his stature saying, hey, you know, I'm leaving, I'm going, you know, at his age, saying, hey, I'm leaving, I'm going to the Portland Timbers, for lack of a better team, right? Or the New York City FC. Now, does MLS and American soccer, which has reined in the idea of dominant clubs, super clubs, clubs whose branding abroad outweighs that of the league, will they embrace this? Because I get the sense this is something completely new. This is uncharted territory for the league. And from talking to people, there is some resentment, like, whoa, they think they're bigger than the league. They think that they invented the sport in this country. No, they didn't. Atlanta United didn't invent the sport in this country, but they certainly did take it to another level that you and your other however many teams, I can't even 20-something teams before, were unable to do, not just in this country, but abroad in terms of credibility of one of your clubs. So that, yeah, to me, is a takeaway from the weekend.
Yeah, I think we don't want a Bayern Munich and a Bundesliga type of level, but I think it's important to have big clubs and dominant clubs that are going to kind of rise up and really kind of attract a lot of people and get a lot of fans to be watching those clubs. So Atlanta United is a perfect example of that, a club that's doing everything right. And I see nothing wrong with that in terms of trying to build that club into a kind of a dominant club and then hope that the others will rise with that too. The challenge is that many of the other ones are making a lot of the wrong decisions and not rising up to that level. So But I think in many ways, too, it incentivizes the other clubs to try harder because they have to in order to compete. But Kartik, I know that you probably didn't watch much of the Premier League Fan Fest over the weekend. And to me, I really enjoyed it. To me, it's a validation for a lot of these fans of clubs from around the country, soccer fans around the country that are fans of Premier League clubs. So it was great seeing on television. You had everything from Leicester City fans, Leeds United fans, Brighton, Cardiff, Newcastle, and of course the big clubs too, Chelsea, Man City, Man United, etc. It was one of those rare days that you had all the major big clubs playing on the Saturday, obviously in England, but with the fans being able to congregate in this place and really celebrate, the fandom of these clubs. And I really enjoyed it. It was good television. It was really, really good to see. And I think at the end of the day, it's validation. It's like if you're a Leicester City fan and you live in Alabama and you're watching it on television, seeing all these other Leicester City fans, it makes you feel that you're part of the club, part of the whole following of this side in this country.
Some quick takeaways from NBC's Premier League coverage this weekend. I did not get to watch most, but I completely forgotten about the Fan Fest. I did not turn NBC on until 12:30 Eastern time on Saturday, and that had something else to do during the 2:45 game. But two quick notes. One, I really liked the job they're doing, the stat crew, placement of graphics, statistical graphics that are relevant during the Newcastle Wolves match on Sunday. They had some really good graphics about Rafa Benitez's record, about Wolves as a newly promoted team, that they just slipped in at a perfect time when John Champion, who I know we're going to get to, talk a lot about him today, I guess, when John Champion mentioned certain things, even though he's not an NBC broadcaster, they were paying attention very clearly to his broadcast for the international feed and pushing good graphics on. The second thing is, Chris, from talking to contacts in the UK, there is beginning to be blowback on this 7:45 p.m. kickoff time on Saturdays from fans. Obviously, that's good for NBC. That's good for the U.S. audience. And Leicester played Spurs this week. That is going to become a normal feature in the new TV contract starting next season. And I'm already picking up both among some other media in the UK and among some fans that they do not like that start time. It's too late for a Saturday night for local fans and for people in the UK to watch. So let's see how that plays out. Obviously, we'll have 3 years of start times at that time. I think it's great for us in the States. I'm excited about it, but some blowback from the UK on that already.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that there's blowback from the UK. To me, though, Kartik, having grown up in the UK and then having lived in the United States now for over, 35 years, to me, it seems to be silly or weird in a way because, I mean, you've got a 7:45 game kicking off local time in the UK. By the time it's over, you mean it's 10 o'clock. And in most major countries in the world, especially in the westernized world, in terms of transportation, there should be no problem getting your transportation back to where you live. Now, I understand in terms of, people living in certain parts of the country where train service ends at Saturday at 10 o'clock at night. But to me, it's part of it is kind of, the transportation system in terms of being open up later so that they can service these types of things going on.
Yeah, okay, that's a big part of it. So fans from the north saying, well, the last train that leaves Houston or leaves Liverpool Street or whichever station going back to my locale, my area, out of London will leave before the end of that match. I'm stuck spending an extra night, spending money and then a night in a hotel room in London if, let's say, Burnley has to play at Crystal Palace in that match.
Which I think for a lot of Americans is probably very strange and weird. It's like, why wouldn't the trains run late and have a later train? I completely understand where the UK's blowback is coming from. And then from my side, I'm saying, there's got to be a way to make this work And again, at the end of the day, it's all about television. So they don't care as much about the actual fans in the stadium, but hopefully it'll transition into making this happen and making this a permanent thing. I enjoy it. It's a full day of football from early morning to late afternoon. It actually ends up being a good day. The River Boca game, Kartik, I won't go into a lot of detail about this one, but I did enjoy it. It was my favorite match of the entire week. And anyone who wants to see just a world-class goal, check out Boca Juniors' first goal that they scored in this game. Just an incredible pass that split the defense. One touch by I forgot who scored it, to jump over a defender and slot the ball into the back of the net. And then River Plate came back. Just a really incredible game. The last 10 minutes of the game, the goalkeeper was up for corner kicks, opposite side of the field, empty goal, empty net. Just crazy, crazy, immense pressure, and just an amazing game. Really, really good game. Fox Deportes, I watched this one on, and Telemundo showed it too.
Yeah, Telemundo was great. Contour was fantastic. For those who maybe haven't watched South American football very much in the past, you might realize that this match was essentially a cross between La Liga and the Premier League. You had a lot of the same kind of great technical goals that you see in La Liga, but you had sort of hard tackling and physical play you tend to see in the Premier League. Mm-hmm. So it was just for a spectacle, because I know people have personal preferences. Some people like League because it's fast and frenzied, and there's a lot of hard tackling and bad giveaways in midfield that lead to quick counterattacks. A lot of people like La Liga because it's the build-up is very technical, the touches are better than the Premier League, the goals tend to be more spectacular. Premier League has spectacular goals too, but you know what I mean from a technical standpoint than the Premier League. This match was basically the combination of the two. That's simplifying it a bit.
That's a good point. That's a good description of it, Kartik. I completely agree. And also, even in terms of the speed and the just frenetic nature of the game, it reminded me of some of the best Premier League in terms of just crazy. You're like, oh my gosh, this match is going insane. Rather than symptoms, maybe say La Liga, where it's more tranquilo, just kind of relaxed, calm under pressure, pass. It had that passion, and of course you got the fan base too on top of that. That adds a whole other degree of just amazingness. But really, really good game. Kartik, so Champions League. So Let's avoid the Spurs-Barcelona game for a second and talk about everything else from the Champions League from this week, from Turner's broadcasting. Turner, again, to Kartik, doing a great job. I think Tuesday, pre-match, they had a live tactical breakdown of Kubayi against Mo Salah. And this is their prediction of, kind of showing some pre-match, showing some other games that they played against each other and how they kind of Kubayi was able to kind of really take Salah out of the game. And which is really, really good because in the game itself, Salah's goal came from kind of Salah being able to get past Kubayi. But really, really good tactical breakdown there on the set. And also enjoyed the walkthrough that Stu Holden and Steve Nash did of La Masia in Barcelona, showing them kind of basically all these greats and these young stars of the future. Kind of where they reside and what their environment is like that too, and I thought pre-match, I thought Stuart Holden and Steve Nash, they have a really good chemistry together. Kartik, we've talked about this before, but I really honestly think that their chemistry is better than the chemistry between John Strong and Stu Holden. I think John Strong is a little bit more, seems to be more uptight and more kind of straight-laced, and I think with Steve Nash, Stu gets to kind of relax a little bit more and kind of joke back and forth a little bit better, and the chemistry to me works really, really well together. Now that's pre-match. The game itself, the Spurs Barcelona game, I understand this was an experiment. I understand that in terms of them wanting to try something different, and as you said, Kartik, I think in some of your Twitter comments, your criticism was more about the actual production in terms of the decision to do this. But to me, what a car crash this was. This was absolutely horrible in terms of just first starting off with the mics not working. I mean, Stu Holden's mic not working correctly, so it sounded horrible. But at the same time, you have the Liverpool-Napoli game. I'm watching that game, and I go back to the Barcelona-Spurs game like every few minutes just to listen in and check in. And the energy level was completely flat. I mean, it seemed to be like, I don't know, 30 seconds with no talking. It just was really, really bad. And to me, I kept on going back to the Liverpool-Napoli match and ended up sticking with that.
So, Chris, I don't technically disagree. I know a lot of people have pushed back on me, got text messages from people about my tweets about this. I don't technically disagree. I think the thing we have to remember is it was a first match for Stu Holden doing play-by-play, being the main commentator. He's conversational type guy.
I think he's done stuff before, though. I mean, he did Facebook Live, I think, last season or the season before.
Wasn't Rachel Panetta hosting those?
She was hosting it, but then usually she'd hand it over to whoever.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But I think he commentated one of those. Those really aren't even commentary, so it's almost like kind of a discussion, a conversation. But I get what you're saying in terms of this is his first time really doing a television commentary.
Yeah, and I think for me, if you're going to experiment with this sort of thing and then try and get some live on-site commentators that are your commentators that are speaking to your audience, might as well do it in toward the end of the group stage rather than start doing this in the knockout stages in the semifinals of the Champions League. So. And obviously, this match was an occasion. Seems Steve Nash has a lot of access to Spurs for obvious reasons. So it was a pretty and to Pochettino himself. So it was a pretty good match, I think, to pick this. Now, did this format work? Probably not. But I think it's pretty clunky. And quite frankly, Chris, the ratings are so low, I don't think it turns off that many viewers. I mean, we just got to remember how few people are watching this. And maybe you experiment with things that can engage new viewers.
Yeah, I think this would have had the complete opposite effect, though, to Kartik. It was that bad. I mean, that's the thing, though, too. I mean, that Steve Nash got a lot of criticism for being a Spurs fanboy. You mean just talking about Spurs throughout the entire game, and just, you mean, if you're a neutral, if you're a Spurs fan watching this, you're probably okay. But even then, they probably wouldn't have enjoyed it. But for everyone else, it's like this is just not right. I mean, to me, at the end of the day, I think last podcast I said, I think that they made the right decision going with the Spurs-Barcelona game. In hindsight, going into this, I think it was the wrong decision. They should have had the Liverpool-Napoli game on this one. You mean, imagine Stu Holden and Steve Nash at Anfield for that game. It would have been better in terms of atmosphere. But even going into the match twice before the game started, Steve Nash said this doesn't mean anything. This game doesn't mean anything for Barcelona. So as a viewer who was planning on probably watching a lot of this game, I was like, you know what? Do I really want to watch this game? No, I'll just go ahead and watch the Liverpool-Napoli game instead, and I'll tune in back and forth and see what how things are going on the Spurs match. But I think it was just a really bad mistake by Turner Sports. Hopefully they've learned from this. Hopefully they won't do this again. It just did not work at all. I mean, Stu Holden's a great analyst, but he does not have the style of a commentator. And even halftime, too. I think halftime you had the highlights from the game. But rather than them using the actual commentary from Stu and Steve Nash, you had, I think, Jonathan Pierce doing the commentary. And the game sounded like it was much more alive. It sounded like it was more energetic. It sounded like it was more exciting. And to me, with Stu Holden and Steve Nash in the game, it just was very flat, very unenergetic. It was just really just a toll, like kind of to get through this game. So hopefully they've learned the lesson.
Yeah, but, and hopefully production-wise, if they do another live telecast like this with their own commentators, the transitions, you could almost tell watching when they were cutting from images and microphones that were part of the UEFA feed to their own commentary. There were just, and again, this is difficult, and I'm picking on production this week for whatever reason, because I wasn't happy with how Fox handled the MLS Cup with the camera work and the cutaways and that sort of stuff. And again, I don't have any critiques of the actual program of the MLS Cup, the commentators, Strong and Holden or Lawless, etc. In studio, my critique is about the production. My concern, Chris, is that Turner, if they do this again, even if it's with a different set of commentators, they've got to get that mic work right. That creates some of the flatness you're talking about, and it's very subtle. Maybe it's because you and I have watched so much media and television through the years that we pick up on it more easily than others do. But that's a concern for me, because then that kind of sucks the energy out of a telecast.
Yeah. The other thing too is that the audio wasn't synced up with the video. So we've seen this so many times in the past with Fox where it just wasn't synced up, and we're like, oh my god, not again. And that to me is like that's almost even worse than a bad mic. Is that you're hearing the analysis either a second or two before it happens or a second or two after it happens, rather than it feeling live. And to me, that was just, please.
I thought it was my television, so I changed the channel and then changed it back. And Nash's voice was still, his lips were not synced with what was coming out still after I changed the channel. So I thought maybe it's on my end.
Right. Well, that's what I thought too when I was watching it, I think through Fubo, watching it on TNT. But then, yeah, it wasn't. It was completely the video and audio were not synced up. Moving on to Wednesday, I didn't pay as much attention to, just because the games didn't mean as much. A lot of them were kind of done and dusted for the most part, other than kind of places within the groups. And the matches for me weren't as appealing as they were on Tuesday. But pre-match on Wednesday, a really good piece about Nuri from Ajax, a player that is not able to play again. A young star that was... They thought that there would be thought a lot of good things would come out of this player, and unfortunately, he's never going to be able to play again. And it was just a really stirring, emotional segment, well produced, really well produced by TNT about kind of the background about the story. And I thought that was really well done and great television. And I was like, wow, this is good. This is really, really good stuff. And then, of course, we talked about. Tim Howard and Mo Adu and Kate Abdo talking about racism in soccer, and that was well done too. All right, Kartik, let's move on to the TV streaming news, and I'll have you kick it off, Kartik, with the big news.
Yeah, big news of the week here in the States, or actually in the UK as well. John Champion is moving to the United States to commentate on MLS games for ESPN. Former guest who's been a frequent guest on this show, ESPN producer Amy Rosenfeld, also a guest on this show in the past, said it will be determined on a case-by-case basis whether Champion can call Premier League games and tournaments if it doesn't interfere with his ESPN work. This is a fantastic move for Major League Soccer. It really kind of elevates the level of commentary And next year, they do have the MLS Cup. So Champion will call the MLS Cup alongside Taylor Twellman. It's a big, big move for ESPN. I think it's disappointing from a Premier League perspective and from quite frankly, an EFL perspective, right, from a championship perspective in terms of especially that Friday match. But it really kind of ups the ante in terms of commentators here in the United States. And I think, Chris, it is important to note this. I know that this is I don't want to get people here. And there's a lot of and I actually am a political liberal. There's a lot of anger among the left saying, oh, who would want to live in the United States now? I see more and more people who are professional in Europe saying, you know what, if we have the opportunity to move and live and raise our family in the United States, we're going to do it, even more than in the past. So, I mean, this thing cuts both ways, and it's great to have him here. He'll be in the States. We have seen commentators based in the United States be able to still do work in Europe. Derek Ray moved back to the United States a year or two ago, and as we've seen, he's been able to do well, he did the Bundesliga game. I should have mentioned that. He did the Werder Bremen Fortuna Dusseldorf match that I watched on Friday, and because he lived in the United States, he was very cognizant of the Josh Sargent issue and kind of commentated on that for an American audience, even though it was the international feed. One last point before I know you get your comments in on this. John Champion has in his commentary as recently as the Wolves Newcastle match I referenced on Sunday, he always works in an angle related to the United States in his commentary at this point, Premier League and championship commentary. So I think he's already becoming comfortable with talking to an American audience. And obviously he's done a lot of matches here as well, including U.S. men's national team matches.
I will be completely honest. When I heard this news earlier this week, I was depressed. It really depressed me for that day. I was just so shocked. Now, Kartik, you and I have met John on a couple occasions, maybe two or three occasions. Just a great guy. I would consider him a friend. I mean, he's a really, really down-to-earth. He's a gentleman. He's everything you could expect for an English football commentator, one of the greats to be. And I understand in terms of from ESPN, this is a huge coup. For Major League Soccer, this is a huge coup. For John Champion and his family, this is a huge opportunity. He's really, when you think about it, he's mastered the European game. You mean in terms of whether it's for World Cups or whether it's for the Premier League or whether it's Championship or you name it, he's done it, and he's done it for decades. So this would be an opportunity to go into a new market, to actually help ESPN, to help MLS. That would make a huge difference, and to go into an environment where there's an opportunity for it to grow. But on a personal level, I'm really, to me, one of the main major reasons I watch the Premier League is because of John Champion. And it was just weird to say, but it is. It's one of those things. If I know that John Champion is calling whatever game it is on the weekend, I will go out of my way to listen to that game more so than if it was some other commentator. And that's something, too. Even on the feedback we've got in the comments section on World Soccer Talk, I wrote a commentary piece about this, and the piece was talking about this leaves a gaping hole for commentators in the UK, because who rises up to that level? Who fits in? Who tries to fill the shoes of John Champion? And the feedback we got from our listeners and our readers were a lot of similar stories, saying like he's a main reason I really follow the Premier League, or I'm attracted to the Premier League. And I really wonder, Kartik, if the Premier League and IMG and TWI and everyone that's responsible for the world feed and the production really understand how much of a factor John Champion is in the popularity of the Premier League. I mean, he's one of many factors. He's not the factor. But I wonder how hard they try to keep him there. Do they say, hey, okay, yeah, maybe ESPN's offering you more money, perhaps, and a better lifestyle, but what are we going to offer, counter-offer, to try to get him to stay in the UK? And again, on a personal level, I understand why he's doing it. And in these discussions we've had and the conversations we've had in person with him, he's always interested in Major League Soccer. He's always asking what we think about this and what we think about the TV coverage. And he's a listener to this podcast, so I know he's listening to this right now. But to me, him leaves a huge hole in the Premier League broadcast worldwide. And I'm going to miss him. It's not going to be, the Premier League is not going to be the same without him.
Yeah, and let me speak for the championship as well. I mean, I think I've confessed this on this show before, that I've turned championship matches off, Friday championship matches, if he's not the commentator. Because part of the reason I listed that, I didn't, because of the Josh Sargent and Derek Ray, who's another one of our favorites, was calling that match. I didn't watch West Brom Villa this week, although normally I would have. A West Midlands derby, I absolutely would have watched. Watch a lot of matches or get more engaged in matches if he's the commentator. There's no two ways about it. As I turned championship matches off, I don't know that I turned Premier League matches off or set my schedule based on the matches he's commentating, but I listen more closely when he's the commentator. And he has that unique ability to storytell, to call a match, let a match breathe, and give some insight and opinion. I don't know many other commentators that have that ability. I mean, I would say Derek Ray is on that list, or maybe one or two others, Martin Tyler. I'm talking about worldwide. So it is a huge loss for English football. Again, I take this from an American perspective. I'm an American. I live in this country. I'm very excited. I'm really excited to have John Champion here calling matches. And I think he will also elevate the level of the discussion around Major League Soccer and U.S. soccer. I assume this means he'll call some U.S. men's national team games or some more matches. I'm not sure. Maybe Ian Dark is going to continue to do those. And Steve McManaman is still hanging around. He was on ESPN FC this week, by the way. So he still has some role in what's going on. But you see also, Chris, from this, the contrast between ESPN's approach and Fox's approach. And maybe this is a tired subject on this program. But when you talk about the level of the commentators, the level of the willingness to critique the certain elements of the sport in this country, it's just night and day.
Yeah, and that's one thing we'll have to wait and see in terms of his commentary of Major League Soccer games, whether he's going to call it the way he sees it. I mean, he always has in the past in terms of the Premier League. He's been politically correct about it. I don't think he's been kind of like he's not a negative person by any means, but you mean if a free kick's a horrible free kick, he'll call it a horrible free kick. And we know that within Major League Soccer, sometimes that commentators or analysts are a little bit very much don't want to kind of hurt the feelings of anyone and wanting to help try to grow the sport and say the right things. And hopefully that won't happen. I don't think it will with John, but we'll see.
Yeah, so let me tie a bow on this conversation, because Derek Ray keeps coming up in this conversation. One, John Champion has said that stuff during Premier League matches and championship matches I've watched, saying, well, this is really an underwhelming match. This match wasn't of the quality we expected. I don't know how that gets received by MLS. Now, when Derek Ray used to commentate on MLS matches, this was many, many moons ago, and we have a lot of new fans in this country and a lot of people who don't remember that, he got criticized incessantly by the MLS, for lack of a better term, fanboy community for not only on ESPN broadcasts, but also on New England Revolution broadcasts for pointing out the quality of what he was seeing in certain matches. He wasn't always that way. Mm-hmm. It was based on the match. So again, to me, he's the standard of commentators who've been based in the United States through the years. Derek Ray's number one on that list for me. John Champion brings a similar skill set to the job. Are we now more mature as a soccer nation to where there was so much pushback on Ray's commentary 15 years ago? Is there going to be the same sort of pushback on Champion? I hope not. I think probably not, but we'll see.
So John Champion's last game commentating the Premier League is going to be scheduled for January 29th. It's Newcastle United against Manchester City. And NBC, please, 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 please make sure that Arlo's not doing that game, and just let John Champion and let soccer fans around the United States be able to hear John Champion's official last Premier League game. And as Kartik said, there's an opportunity perhaps maybe that he might do some games in the future, but it all depends on schedule. And with MLS's schedule and with the Premier League matches, with the commentators being at the stadium, Those schedules might not sync up, and it might be very, very rare that we get to hear John Champion call a Premier League game again in a very, very long time. So January 29th, Newcastle, Man City, NBC Sports, please. All right, Kartik, moving on to the next news item, and that is the MLS Cup Final, the much-anticipated, much-talked-about game. The viewing figure for this one was on over-the-air Fox, the Fox network, and it had 1.5 million viewers. Kartik, what's your take? Is this a good number or a bad number?
I think it's a pretty good number, but the number was spiked by Atlanta being in the match. The rating, local rating in the Atlanta market was over an 11 share, which is pretty good for, and in the Portland market was over a 7 share. I think the next highest market was Austin or Milwaukee. West Palm Beach, by the way, was in the top 5 also. Your market, your television market.
Yep.
And those were all kind of in the ones. So I think it was spiked. It's a good number. Don't take anything away. And I know the MLS fans are going to come after me. It is a very good number. But if you have two different teams, if it had been Sporting Kansas City against New York Red Bull, we might be looking at a 0.9 or a 1, honestly. The right teams got in. Now, this might be a good thing for MLS going forward because I think Atlanta's going to be playing in this game an awful lot, as we talked about earlier in the show, although it's a bit of a crapshoot, the playoff format. But the number is good, Chris, but I have to point out again, it was spiked by the two teams that are in it. And Atlanta, this is something important about this television market, but I think a lot of people who were skeptical of how soccer would work in that market did not pick up on. Atlanta is a notoriously fickle sports market, we hear, in terms of attendance. However, if you look at the local television ratings on local cable for the Atlanta Braves, local television ratings on their Fox affiliate for Atlanta Falcons games, you're higher than the vast majority of markets in the country in terms of their local market share. There are people who don't go to games, but they watch them on television. Now, Atlanta United hasn't had an attendance problem, obviously, but there are that many more people watching games on television. So it is a killer television market. And having that for local sports, having an Atlanta team in the final and then hosting the match made this rating what it was. So the question, Chris, is you wrote an article earlier in the week on World Soccer Talk, highest rating since 2002. Is this an outlier? Because Atlanta was in the game.
Yeah.
And we might not know, we won't know until next year if someone else is in it instead of Atlanta.
Yeah. And actually, I amended the article too, Kartik, because it's actually the highest number since 1997, the 1.5 million viewers.
Okay.
Which is even better. So my take on this is that MLS has hit a ceiling. That I don't think they're going to get beyond this number. Yes, it's a good number, but all the things coming together in terms of having Atlanta playing at home in this stadium, Atlanta with Tata Martino and all these great players, and this team playing so well, and with next year, the final will be on ESPN and not on Fox again for another couple of years, the chances of having Atlanta United in a final against the Portland are going to be even slim. It might be, like you said, Sporting Kansas City against Colorado Rapids or something like that in a final. Or New York Red Bulls. I mean, take a New York market. New York Red Bulls against LA Galaxy. This TV number is not going to hit that number, that 1.5 million number. Unless it's Atlanta United or again. But that's my take on it. I don't think we're going to get much past this in the future. It's a great number for MLS, and I think they should just remember this. And this will probably go down in history as probably the most watched MLS Cup final for a long time to come. All right, Kartik, let's move on to the next news item.
Yeah, big news this week, potentially for the landscape of soccer in Canada, which is or for television in Canada, which is DAZN getting apparently the English Premier League rights. This would move it off of television, off of Sportsnet or TSN, and to DAZN, which is a streaming platform, which. You know, they've taken up part of Champions League already in Canada. The reaction I've gotten initially, now the conversation with my Canadian friends has shifted to the Ottawa Fury situation with CONCACAF. That's a whole other governance issue. But when this initially broke, was really kind of anger and shock. And wondering why the Premier League, given their success being on broadcast television in the United States, would go to another to a completely different model in Canada, a market which historically the Premier League was more popular in than the United States until recently. So there was a lot of unhappiness among the Canadian soccer fans I've talked to about this. But Chris, I think this is just going to be the reality, particularly with DAZN throwing what we believe is a lot of money at this sort of stuff.
Yeah, this is a big story, Kartik. I mean, it revolves around Canada. But the reality is that... this means that if you're living in Canada for next season, The only way to watch the Premier League is through DAZN. So if you're a cord cutter, you can have access to every single Premier League game through DAZN in Canada, which it's a huge story. But to me, this is a huge story, Kartik, because I can see now DAZN moving in, looking at whatever next rights are available. I can see them picking up the Bundesliga in the United States and saying, hey, Bundesliga exclusively on DAZN. I can see DAZN going in for La Liga, putting a big bid in for La Liga. Maybe Univision on the Spanish side acquires that side, but on the English language side, DAZN could get that too. And you go on from there. This is a big move and a big statement of intent. And I think it's only a matter of probably months before we hear about DAZN picking up some rights in the United States for some other big soccer properties, or sub-licensing some of these games or leagues from other companies and offering some big money. And those ads, Kartik, I keep on seeing those ads all the time. It's unstoppable. Next up, Barcelona has withdrawn their proposal to play Girona in the game in Miami that was scheduled for January 29th, I believe, in the part of La Liga. In our interview we had a few weeks ago with the CEO of La Liga North America, he did say that if this game didn't happen, they'd try again in September. So I think that's where we're at right now, is that La Liga and relevant sports will continue to try to get these games played in the United States. It's likely not going to be Barcelona. It could be Real Madrid, or some other team, Valencia perhaps, or whoever it may be. But a 15-year deal, at some point, they're going to make this happen, I'm sure. And Kartik, lastly, just one more news item. This is another big one.
Yeah, kind of a stunner. 11 Sports may be facing closure in the UK after only 4 months. They haven't attracted enough subscribers. And as our listeners know, there's been a lot of controversy about La Liga and Serie A and the showing of 3 p.m. matches. Now, 11 is abiding by those blackouts. There was a hope that there would be enough interest in European football to, and I think they have some non-football rights too, but La Liga and Serie A being the big ones, to sign up enough subscribers to have a Netflix-like model, and it just has not happened. Chris, to me, the story reinforces how few people in the UK watch other leagues, which is why I often, I know people on Twitter think I have this very anti-British British media outlook or British fan. I don't. The issue is that they make us about other leagues without watching them all the time there. And this just kind of reinforces me. There's just not that much interest in other football leagues outside of their own domestic leagues.
Yeah, to me too, Kartik. It really reinforces that the Premier League is massive in the UK, and anything beyond that, there's very little interest in it. And I believe in the article about 11 Sports, it says that they've acquired so far 50,000 subscribers to their streaming service, which is hardly any, really, in a country of millions. And to me, this is not so much a warning sign about streaming in general, but just more a warning sign in terms of a streaming, well, in this case, a company going in, trying to enter a very competitive marketplace where the Premier League has such a huge appeal, and trying to shake things up and trying to get people to subscribe to their service to watch La Liga and other sports. I think it's just a bad fit for 11 Sports in the UK. All right, Kartik, let's move on to TV ratings. We've already talked about the MLS Cup final. We had the Chelsea-Man City game, which was 1.1 million on NBC on Saturday. That's been the most watched Premier League game of the season so far. We had some other big numbers too. We talked about this, we teased this in the opening of the show. The millions and millions of people watching soccer this past weekend. Well, 1.7 million people watched Club America against Pumas on Univision on Sunday. You had 1.3 million for Cruz Azul Monterrey on Univision on Saturday. In our interview last week with Univision Deportes president Juan Carlos Rodriguez, he talked about his dream for the final would have been Club America against Cruz Azul. His wish has come true, and that's going to happen starting tonight, Thursday, the first leg, in what should be some massive numbers there for Univision, in what should be a really, really entertaining two-leg final. River Boca, 1.1 million, Kartik. This was a this is a great number. I mean, 600,000 people on Telemundo and about 400,000 on Fox supporters for a game that wasn't on English language television and got some big numbers for a game that normally doesn't get anything near these numbers.
Yeah, that was a stunning number to me, the most stunning number of the weekend. We expect the high numbers for the semifinals, particularly on Univision over the weekend. And this is something we'll also see with the grand finale, is that the Thursday leg never does as well as the Sunday leg. We'll be talking about that next. That number stunned me. I have to point out, this is the first weekend, Chris, we've had without college football. Of this football season. Well, I mean, I suppose MLS starts way back when, but I think that strategically helps a great deal. MLS Cup next year is going back a couple of weekend where there will be NFL or college football. Maybe they're going to play it on a Sunday. I don't know. And that would avoid the conflict with college football. But this was the first weekend of the year of the football season without college football, and I think that's reflected in the ratings, particularly for the Chelsea-Man City match. 12:30 kickoff time on ESPN, NBC over the air. There is always a big college football game, whether it be on Fox or ABC or ESPN going on, or CBS going on at the same time when NBC has those Premier League. So I think that yes, it was a big match. It was two big teams at the top, near the top of the table, but it also benefited from the week it was.
And then one other number to point out too, and we'll have all of the numbers for all the games on worldsoccertalk.com in the next 24 to 48 hours, but Spurs against Barcelona, the Stu Holden, Steve Nash commentary on TNT on Tuesday, 297,000 viewers. So for a big game like that, featuring two big teams, a pretty good number. Nothing amazing, nothing really bad there.
For me, a big takeaway again, Chris, this week, as I watched three Bundesliga matches in their entirety on Fox, there wasn't a single Bundesliga match that cleared 100,000 viewers in the United States, including a match between Weston McKennie and Christian Pulisic. So the Bundesliga strategy of having Americans on it, because there's just about any Bundesliga match you watch now, there's an American either on the bench or playing, isn't really catching on in this country. Now, maybe that's Fox's fault. I don't know. But this, to me, was pretty telling. I thought that match at least would clear the number for Galatasaray Porto on TNT. Now, obviously, that was a Champions League match, but that got higher numbers. Juventus Inter on a Friday afternoon on ESPN2 got higher numbers. Huddersfield Arsenal tucked away on CNBC, a business channel, and it got higher numbers. So, a lot of problems for the Bundesliga here in the States.
Yeah, for me, you can only watch as much football as you can. And in the Bundesliga, I love to watch the Bundesliga. But when there's other things on, I mean, the Bundesliga gets lower on the priority list. Maybe number three or number four. I mean, we've got La Liga matches on, Serie A matches on. I mean, Champions League, Premier League, Championship. I mean, there's so much soccer on that I think it just gets pushed to the wayside, unfortunately, even with American players. Listener mailbag, we've got a bunch of great feedback this week. The first up is Curtis Williams. He says, I totally enjoyed Sunday's Copa Lib second leg via Fox Deportes. Although I'm not Latino, the match proved to exceed my expectations as a soccer fan. One major positive, both sets of fans behaved themselves from start to finish. By the way, this was the best final I have seen since the 2005 Champions League final between Liverpool and AC Milan. Thank you, and Merry Christmas from Little Rock, Arkansas. Wow, those are some big words there, Kartik, because that final, the 2005 final, still the greatest game I've ever seen in my life, and that River Boca final was definitely good, without a doubt. John Average Geek says, what has Atlanta United done differently from other Atlanta soccer teams that have failed to do in tapping into the local market, money, ownership, marketing, style of play, ? Kartik, what's your take on this one?
Yeah, so having done, obviously worked at the NASL and worked with the Atlanta Silverbacks, and then previous to that covered USL and covered the Atlanta Silverbacks, owner, that makes a big difference. The ownership situation with the Atlanta Silverbacks was always a situation where I think the owner of the team at times was trying to leverage the fact that he owned the soccer park to make money. Two, marketing. Obviously, Arthur Blank has blown it out of the building. Three, local community connections. I can't stress how important it is that Atlanta United got into the local Latino community. They got into the local community of African immigrants. They started sponsoring soccer-related events 2 years before the team kicked the ball. They started recruiting local players for their academy and taking an intake of local players. These are things that the other Atlanta professional soccer teams never did. That ties you to the local community. Then, of course, hiring soccer people. So what we've seen with other Atlanta sports teams, and quite frankly, a lot of minor league teams in the United States in general, is they don't hire soccer people. They hire people who come over from hockey. They hire people who come over from Major League Baseball or minor league baseball. What we've seen with Atlanta United is they went out and hired Darren Eales from Spurs. They hired Carlos Bocanegra, who was the captain of the U.S. men's national team, who's a soccer guy. They hired Paul McDonough, who's now moved on to Miami, but he's a soccer guy through and through and very good at his job. They hired soccer people. Arthur Blank is an NFL owner. He didn't have a background in soccer, but he didn't say, okay, why don't I co-mingle some of my Falcons staff and people that maybe I interviewed for a job and didn't get it here, NFL people, why don't I have them run the soccer team? He didn't do that. Now, that has been a big mistake in Major League Soccer in the past and in the lower divisions, as I mentioned. So they just, we could have a whole podcast on what Atlanta's done right. I don't want to take up the rest of the show.
The one thing I would say that in terms of nationally what Atlanta has done right, and it's a simple thing, is they created a really exciting attacking, a very attacking team. Yep. that wins games. And to me, that's, I mean, the most important formula, part of that formula is having some team play that you're actually excited to watch, that you want to watch. And there's been so many teams in the past before that have been, whether it's locally or nationally, and just in terms of the way that they set up to play, kind of very defensive, and it's just like, oh, you mean it's completely the wrong strategy.
We knew at the very first match they played, they lost to the Red Bulls in their first match in whatever would have been March of 2017. But I remember talking to you and talking to some other people saying, we've never seen a team like this in Major League Soccer.
Especially for a new team, right?
Yeah, yeah. We just hadn't seen that type of football. They didn't win that match, but we saw what Tata was trying to do tactically, conceptually, the type of technical skills their players had. And it was like, you know what? I'm going to keep watching them. And I think there was some podcast last season, that maybe you said the same thing. It's like, the MLS match, which is on Fox or ESPN, we see if Atlanta's playing. And if Atlanta's playing, we watch. If they're not, we don't watch.
Yeah,
and I think that there are a lot of people like that.
It's the type of team that I could see doing well in a FIFA Club World Cup and actually advancing pretty far in terms of not even just the attacking style of football, but just the way that they play. They play, you mean, the right way in terms of positionally, you mean, style of play. They are, you mean, kind of that quintessential kind of world team. It's the team that would translate well to playing against other teams from around the world. Vincent Orozco says, hi, guys. I got a question for you about the Fox coverage of the MLS Cup final. Why did they not interview the MVP of the game? I thought it was weird in the interview that they interviewed the losing coach. I think it would be better if they interviewed the winning team's winning coach and reiterating the storyline that this was his last game. I think Fox got it all wrong on the sideline coverage, in my opinion. They did a gross disservice to Hispanics and not having a Hispanic point of view anywhere in the coverage. Which is true, Kartik. I completely agree with that. There's always the question about Tata Martino and his English, which we know from some interviews that he's done in the past few weeks that he can and does speak a little bit of English. The MVP, you mean? What you mean? I would guess too that he'd be able to speak some English too. Well, if you had a Sebastian Salazar, you mean somebody that could actually be very bilingual sideline that could, you know, go back and forth and translate on the fly. They were missing that, and this is a huge miss for a big game like this one.
Yeah, if they had Seb, it would be different, right? But they don't employ those sorts of people. It seems at Fox that are
or a Hercules Gomez.
Yeah, you know, guys that are multilingual, or guys who are critical, that are able to interpret on the fly. We have seen through the years, Univision in their MLS coverage do interviews in English and have the sideline guy translate it. I remember a number of interviews with Dwayne De Rosario, who was the standout MLS player of his generation, playing for San Jose and Houston, where the Univision sideline reporter would ask him a question in English. He'd answer it in English, and the reporter would translate it on the spot. That's how you do it in these situations. Fox wasn't prepared for this. And then it also gave Gio, who, again, I have a lot of time for, but it gave Gio an opportunity to rip the officials, which I thought was kind of amusing. But, I think it was done because they didn't have anyone who could translate on the spot or at least give Tata Martino, who knows some English, Joseph Martinez, who knows some English, some sort of comfort with the – was Martinez the MVP? I don't even know. I guess – or maybe it was Almiron.
I think so. I'm not sure because actually, once the game was done, I was done. I was okay. Yeah. Switch off the broadcast and move on. So I'm not sure, but that's the other thing though too with this Kartik too is that why didn't Fox, who had the English language rights to the River Boca Copa Libertadores final, why didn't they show it on English language television? Because actually on Twitter, I think a couple of people have tweeted me and said, okay, well, right now on the Fox's, FS1, I think it had a rerun. FS2 had something, some other game. They could have easily put it on. And the thing is, I think that they don't have the talent for it. Because I was thinking to myself, okay, if it was in English, if they did show the game in English language commentary, who would they have among their staff that actually could commentate this game that would know about the history of River Boca, that would know the pronunciations of the players' names, that would be able to do the research to actually put in to commentate this game? And on Twitter, I posted, I said, my dream team would be Max Bredos on a temporary loan from ESPN to Fox, and Ian Joy. And I could see Ian Joy, give him a couple of days, kind of just to get freshen up on the teams and who was going to be starting to play. I could see him giving an expert level of co-commentary. Keith Costigan, I could see Keith doing it too. I mean, so that's the thing that they don't have that talent readily available to step in to do that. And that's a huge miss because we could have watched this game in the English language, the River Boca game, and it would have been incredible. Imagine if you had Max Bredos commentating that. That would have been amazing.
Max would have been my choice to commentate on it. But again, Fox doesn't have him anymore, and I guess they don't have anyone to step up. Or maybe they just see this as a very ethnic property, and they have no interest in showing it in English.
Yeah, it seems to be that way. It seems to be that it's very much, I mean, last year or two, and I've been meaning to write an article about this, it has become very, very MLS-centric and U.S. soccer-centric, whether it's the women's team or the men's team. And they really seem to have kind of, not put much of a focus on the other leagues and not put as much effort into those other leagues to promote them and to give them the respect that they deserve. And maybe they're just saying, okay, well, we'll go through these right cycles, and once it's over, it's over, and then we'll move on, and we'll focus more and more on MLS and U.S. soccer.
Let me backtrack for a minute. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned this in the What We Watched this week. So there were two tactical segments with Tim Howard and Mo Adu in pre-match coverage this week on TNT, which we never saw anything like this in, what was it, the 9 years Fox covered the Champions League, where Tim Howard is in front of a board. You know, it's something that they've taken from NBC and they've taken from Sky Sports. It's not like it's an original creation, but, kind of just showing how a match would play out tactically in the shape of the teams leading into a match that they were broadcasting, right?
You would have seen Lallis and Warren Barton doing it. I mean, and you probably missed a lot of the pregame coverage for a long time. I had to watch this thing week in, week out during the Champions League on Fox. But Warren Barton and Lallis would have gone up to the big TV screen and would have said, okay, here's who's starting. But they wouldn't have gone more in depth in terms of – Tim Howard did great. I thought Tim Howard was really, really good in terms of the tactical analysis. Mo was much better too. They've come a long way, both of them, in a very short amount of time. But Warren Barton, that's probably the first time I've thought or said his name in what, months? It's I'm sorry, Warren, but I don't miss you.
He was doing one of the Bayern games recently, so he's still around.
Oh, he's still around, definitely. But Yeah, it's okay. Christopher Day says, "Hey, Christopher and Kartik, I enjoy the podcast. Keep up the great work. Wondering if you could shed some light on why the Liga MX playoffs don't seem to be on FS1 or FS2, even the replays. I keep only seeing the matches for Monterrey on Fox Deportes, which I don't get. It seemed like Fox made such a big deal about getting the rights, but have been very inconsistent on when they are showing English language broadcasts. Maybe I'm missing something, but the promotion and updated TV listings on my cable programming guide seem to be lacking from Fox. Unfortunately, I don't have the option to cut the cord, as the only internet service provider in our neighborhood is the cable company, and we're roped in with a triple play deal so much. So things like Fubo, unfortunately, are not on the not an option for me unless I want to pay even more each month." And that's a fair point from Christopher Day there, too, is that even the Liga MX games, I mean, just talking about a minute ago about how Fox has kind of seemed to really not focus on any of the ethnic leagues. Fox Deportes, of course, was showing the Monterrey games on the semifinal. But as far as I know, FS1 didn't show the game, which is really strange. They have the rights to it. I mean, Monterrey has a big following. It just not doesn't make any sense. It's just way lower down in their priority list, unfortunately. Ritik says, "Do you guys know why Fox stopped showing Bundesliga games on their main channel? They've shown Dortmund Bayern games in previous seasons, but not the one a few weeks ago. It would have been the perfect opportunity to attract a larger audience to the Bundesliga. I also remember watching a Stuttgart Hanover game on Big Fox a few seasons ago, so they did not feature the big Bundesliga games, clubs only. Thank you." That weekend, Kartik, was a weekend when it was the Dortmund Bayern game. It was a weekend when there was college football on FS1, and so they think the game was on FS2, which most correct people don't get. And again, too, Fox hasn't been showing as many games on their network for the Bundesliga.
No.
And again, we don't know why. We can only assume that it's just not a priority for them anymore. Tim Keane says, "I thought I would just add a couple of comments to the FanFest. As much as Rebecca Lowe tries to talk it up, 2,000 people in New York is a pretty poor turnout, and I find the whole thing distracting as the analysis and comments go out the window as we have to hear from fans shouting and screaming and trying to get in the camera behind the presenters. As always, it's East Coast-centric, and if you didn't know anything about the Premier League, you would think there were only a few teams involved rather than 20. You have been discussing supporting your local team over the last few weeks, but here again we see that anyone who doesn't support the big teams is essentially frozen out. To me, it's a bust, and perhaps I'm just a curmudgeonly Watford supporter." the fans behind the presenters making funny faces, the guy with a tongue back and forth and screaming and shouting. As far as analysis, you're not going to get analysis. Even with Alan Shearer there and talking to him, you're not going to be hearing much of it. It's like a party atmosphere, and it is what it is. 2,000 people, I mean, the actual place that they had it in was filled to capacity, and it was their largest fan fest that they've had to date. Maybe next time they'll open it up and have it in a bigger venue. I've hinted to them too. I've said in the past before, it'd be great if you guys actually came out instead of doing it in New York and Washington, D.C., but maybe Miami, maybe the Midwest. But I think a lot of it is in terms of logistics. It costs a lot of money to go on the road, but also in terms of time. And with the Premier League weekends, usually Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, that's a lot of planning to be able to do to go to, say, Chicago and do something there. But maybe in the future, perhaps they'll make it happen if there's enough support.
I want to address the analysis point, because I think that is so important. That's part of the reason I don't bother with these fan fests and don't like them, is that there's no analysis that weekend. So if you left one of one of the analysts back in Stamford, maybe and you have a remote, you throw it to them, maybe it would be a little better. I don't know.
To me, it would be kind of sad, though. It'd be like, I don't know, Carlo Martino, left back in Stamford. It looks all lonely in the studio. Meanwhile, everyone's having a lot of fun in sunny Washington, D.C. or wherever it may be. But yeah, I get your point, though, too. Yeah, the analysis goes right out the window on a weekend like that. Last but not least, Monty Reed says, Love the podcast. I listen to it every week. Question, with a lot of games being postponed in France due to the protests, how does that affect the TV contracts for Ligue 1 now that beIN Sports have it here in the US and other companies throughout the world? I assume they have clauses in the contract when you remove several matches from your programming that surely affects advertisers since the commercials are not going to be seen. I also assume that the same effects have happened with the Copa Libertadores final. I watched the final on my local Telemundo station with 4 minutes to go in overtime. They cut it off and went to other programming. What? Needless to say, I was very, very frustrated. I emailed my local station and messaged them on Facebook. Oh, my God.
Wow.
Oh, I can't
believe
that
didn't happen here because I was watching on Telemundo as well.
I was watching on Fubo, the Fox supporters feed. But and I looked at the Telemundo feed every once in a while, too, to see how that was going with Andres Cantor. As far as Monty's question, in terms of the TV contracts, I mean, these games will be played. So, yes, for beIN Sports or for Ligue 1, it's a huge hit. I mean, it's now 2 weeks of without any major games being played in France. Sporadically, there's been some games played. Fortunately, I guess, in a way, for beIN Sports, I mean, Ligue 1 is not a big player, so it's not going to have as much of a damaging effect. But these games will be played, so even though they weren't played last week or the week before, they will be played at some point. So in terms of viewership, in terms of advertisers, those agreements will be fulfilled. It's just it's some of these things that Ligue 1 has no control over in terms of things happening, like protests and shutting down cities to kind of deal with this. So so that answered that question. And the Copa the Lib final. Well, the Copa Lib final, the game that was played on the game that was postponed on the Sunday, I believe it was, when they had the second leg. No, actually, the Saturday. The first time the game was postponed when they had the bus was all smashed up. That one had actually big ratings. That one had more viewership for that game than the MLS game on the FS1 on the Sunday, which was, I think, a playoff game. So actually for the Copa Lib, for say Fox Deportes, they got more bang for the buck out of that one because they actually had tried to broadcast a game three times. Two of those times the game wasn't shown, but they still had the viewers tuning in to watch the game and still had some big numbers to share that they could go back to their advertisers and say, hey, look how many people were watching this game, even though it was cancelled or postponed. And then the third time, then, you mean, they get to show the game and the ratings were great. So, yeah, there you go. All right, so listeners, if you do want to reach us and if you have any comments about any soccer games you've watched or would like some advice or want to rant and rave or agree or disagree with anything we've said, you can always reach us via email through web@worldsoccertalk.com as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk and on Twitter @worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can always reach us through the comments section on worldsoccertalk.com. So thank you for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, TuneIn, iTunes, Audioboom, and worldsoccertalk.com. If you like the show, share it with your friends on social media and give us a review on iTunes. And heading into another big week of football from around the world, enjoy your football.